Delivering my first sermon from this pulpit as the associate minister of University Congregational Church is a humbling experience. First of all, Dr. Robert Myers is not exactly an easy act to follow. As I have come to know him both professionally and personally over the past several months, I've found him to be one of the most unique, brilliant, gifted, and genuinely sincere people I have ever met. And that's before he utters a single word from this pulpit. As for his pulpit skills, what can I say? I'm reminded of the story of the two Indian tribes living in New Mexico in the 1940s. They lived many miles from each other and normally communicated with smoke signals. One day, as they were conversing back and forth, something amazing happened. The chief of one of the tribes sent up what he believed to be the most masterful smoke signal in the history of the world. Now understand, this wasn't one of those come on over and visit or we'll see you tomorrow type of smoke signals. This thing would have taken a couple of paragraphs to expound in English. Immediately following this masterful message, as he was patiently awaiting a response from the chief of the neighboring tribe, the United States exploded its first atomic bomb right there in that New Mexico desert. So the chief, who had moments before delivered what he believed to be the mother of all smoke signals, looked at the warrior standing beside him, pointed to the giant mushrooming cloud, and in the most humble voice said, "Wow, I wish I'd said that." Well, that's kind of how I feel following Dr. Myers in the pulpit. And when he suggested that it would be a good idea for my first sermon to tell something of my faith journey, to inform the congregation as straightforwardly as possible how it is that I came to be standing here today, I reluctantly agreed to take his advice. I say reluctantly because I believe each of us is responsible for our own relationship with God, and I believe that relationship is sometimes very personal, to the point of being unexplainable with language. I have discovered in the past that when I attempt to explain my personal faith, my relationship with God, I come off sounding like either a fundamentalist or a raving lunatic. And I like to believe I am neither. And so, a final word of caution: if the story of my faith journey leaves you cold, give me another chance, and we'll examine this remarkable creation another time from a less personal point of view. Like all of you, my faith journey began as a child. My parents took my brother and me to church until we were old enough to tell them we were going to commit Harry Carey if they made us go to that dreadful place one more time. So my childhood church experience ended sometime shortly after my grade school experience began. But I don't want to leave the wrong impression about my parents. I was raised in a solid, loving family and was taught to treat people right, pull my own weight, and cherish the gift of life. Now, as I was growing up, I became one of those kids who constantly questioned everything. Aside from playing the devil's advocate, not a nice term for a future minister, for every idea my family and school tried to get into my head, I was absolutely obsessed with the universe. I wanted to know exactly how big the universe is, what this time business is all about, and would somebody please explain to me why it is people die? My mother used to say to me, "If you don't stop thinking about all that stuff, you're going to drive yourself crazy." When I was in my early teens, I became obsessed with philosophy. And in my mid-teens, I became obsessed with religion. These two things, philosophy and religion, have been my companions ever since. I fear now that I'm giving you the wrong impression, though, about my younger days. If you have pictured in your mind a young man quietly poring over his books in the humble search for truth and enlightenment, I have succeeded in completely deceiving you. In fact, for all my philosophical meanderings, I had come to the conclusion that Jean-Paul Sartre had perfectly and precisely determined the nature of this reality in which we find ourselves. To paraphrase Sartre, mankind is destined to be free. I am a man, and there is no law in the universe other than my own. And life? Life is nothing more than an empty bubble on a sea of nothingness. The bottom line of all this is I had come to the conclusion that there is no God anywhere in all of reality, and we human beings are trapped within empty, meaningless lives. So how does a person respond to life when he has reduced life to a philosophical game with no rules and no meaning? My personal response, frankly, was to turn life into a party. Like the protagonist in the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, life is fleeting, so grab it with gusto. Eat, drink, and be merry, the holy trinity of the Epicurean. I assume you've guessed by my presence here today that this story does not end with my mind imprisoned by the philosophy of Jean-Paul Sartre and my heart in the firm grasp of Omar Khayyam. In fact, that is where my faith journey actually begins. The remarkable medieval mystic St. John of the Cross describes an experience he calls the dark night of the soul. I doubt if I am alone in this room this morning in saying I have experienced my own dark night of the soul. For me, this dark night took the form of my coming to the undeniable conclusion that there is no God in this universe. Once I truly believed I had proven this to myself, I was unable to function as a human being. At that point, I did something that made absolutely no sense. I would find this experience perfectly described many years later in the writing of Soren Kierkegaard. In the face of overwhelming rational odds, I fell to my knees and prayed to a God I knew was not there. I allowed the whole of reality to become centered within my meaningless existence and prayed that somehow, somewhere, some way, there is a God. Kierkegaard describes this as a leap of faith. And I was answered. I felt the unmistakable presence of God. I was instantly, spiritually healed. In the twinkling of an eye, existence became creation. And I knew that there is a force in this universe we cannot understand, but upon which the entire universe is built. This force is a love so complete, so forgiving, so unconditional that we can only bow before it in awe. But we don't refer to this force as it, because the word it refers to something impersonal. And this force is not impersonal. We call this force God, and God is the Father of us all, and the Mother of us all, and the reason creation exists. So how does one respond to this experience? What does a person do with his life once God has become an experiential reality? Many people respond by listening to the fundamentalist preachers they've rejected prior to the experience. This is what I did. I picked up the Bible and turned to people preaching the Word of God. But I soon discovered that if I believed women were created on equal footing with men and deserved to make their own choices in life, if I believed God took billions of years to create the universe, and in fact is still creating the universe, instead of having done all the work in 6 days and then taken a well-deserved break, if I believed that this world is something to be embraced as God's glorious creation, not shunned as some sort of evil from which we will escape at death, if we have recited the proper creeds and believed the things we are told to believe, no matter how unbelievable those things are, if I believed personally that Jesus Christ is the incarnation, but all paths of worship lead to the same God, If I believed these things, I was not really a person of God, and I certainly had no right to call myself a Christian. So I rejected organized religion. I still read many of the works of Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, and Islam, but I refused to join any organized sect or denomination. Over the years, I enjoyed the blessings of God. I've been blessed with a wife who truly completes me. Lee is the joy of my life, and I thank God for her every day. And three daughters are the pride of my life. Two are in college, and the third, Corinne, lives with us here in Wichita. And as much as it is going to embarrass her, I'm going to tell a story about Corinne because it plays a large role in my faith journey. Corinne had an extremely difficult birth. She was delivered by C-section, born with a dislocated hip, and an out-of-shape head that looked like it was being distorted by one of those funhouse mirrors. She refused to eat. She didn't respond to us or the nurses. And on the third day of life, the doctors finally realized she had meningitis. She'd had two spinal taps by the time she was 10 days old, and the news wasn't good. Because of the white blood cell count, the doctors could tell that the damage was severe. We were told she would be mildly, more probably severely, retarded, and would show physical signs of the illness throughout her life. Normal school was unlikely, but chances were good she would be able to learn to walk well enough to get around on her own. To add to all of this, the night nurse misread the doctor's orders. Because Corinne had so many needles in her, she was given intravenous blood thinners several times a day. The nurse accidentally gave her 10 times the prescribed dosage. Corinne was isolated for several days from any type of contact. We were told that a bruise would have resulted in her bleeding to death. Well, you can imagine how I felt. Everything that could go wrong had gone wrong. I was so upset. I remember praying to God, asking, why? Why? And then something awful occurred to me. I wasn't praying for Corinne, and I wasn't praying for my wife, Lee. I was praying for me. How could God do this to me? Didn't God know I would find it embarrassing to be seen with this child? Didn't God know this was messing up my life? The truth of my selfishness fell on me like a ton of bricks. I was so ashamed for being so selfish, and with everything that is within me, I pulled myself together in prayer and promised God that I would love Corinne with all my heart and with all my soul every moment of my life. I promised God that I would never be ashamed of that precious, beautiful girl, and I thanked God for giving me the opportunity to share my life with her. And for the second time in my life, I felt God answer my prayer. I was filled to overflowing with God's love. God had once again healed me of my selfishness. Well, by the time Corinne was 1 year old, the pediatrician would call other doctors to come see Corinne when she was in for an appointment. He would show them her charts, all the problems she'd had at birth, and the severity of the meningitis, and they would marvel at how normal she seemed. That child, the one who wasn't supposed to go to normal school, the one who might be able to walk, she not only goes to normal school, she seldom brings home anything other than A's, and she not only walks, last year she was awarded the title Miss Petite Jazz of Oklahoma in a dance competition, recognizing her as one of the best dancers in that state in her age group. Well, after all this, you might think I would have grabbed the Bible and run all over the countryside thumping it. But I didn't. I still found myself at war with the organized church. The idea of an elect, the idea that God chose a few people to set aside for heaven while the rest of humanity were rejected for eternity, that whole concept is in opposition to the God I have experienced. The God who calls creation into being with unconditional love so we can live lives filled with joy and love. And then one Sunday morning, I was shaving. As was my custom, I turned on the radio as I shaved, and it wasn't on the usual station. I heard some radio preacher talking about some controversial issues. After a few minutes, I ran in and got Lee. And for several months, we listened every Sunday morning to this preacher who taught that God was unconditional love, and the church's job was to build bridges of understanding between all people and not walls of doctrinal separation. This preacher was Robin Myers, son of our own Robert Myers. Lee and I joined the church, became very active members, and after several years, Robin gave me the encouragement I needed to throw caution to the wind, truly turn my life over to God, and enter seminary. And now, here I am. I want to finish my message this morning by letting you know what it means to me to be called as a minister by the people of this church. First, let me warn you, as I like to tell my friends at seminary, God has called me to be a servant, not a saint. I have all the weaknesses and shortcomings that one would expect in a 20th century human being on the planet Earth, and I promise you I will never pretend to be anything other than exactly what I am, and I ask you to accept me with all my imperfections. Congregationalists, I believe, have the right idea about their ministers. A pastor is called by the congregation to serve and minister the people of a church. In some congregational traditions, the minister is called reverend only as long as he is serving the church. When he leaves or retires, he is no longer called by that name because that would insinuate that his status has somehow been elevated above the rest of the congregation. Congregationalism is a church of equals. And I like that, and it is my honor to be called a member of University Congregational Church. To serve in a ministerial capacity for this congregation is for me a source of both great pride and great humility. As a provider of pastoral care, I will be getting to know many of you very well. We will share some moments of great joy, and we will share some of the most difficult times in life. One thing I've learned in this life, sometimes prayers are answered and sometimes they aren't. Sometimes we have to accept things we don't want to accept. The fact is, I do not believe God is in the habit of interfering with the physical laws of creation. God works through those laws. And the healing power of God is truly miraculous, whether it happens quickly and inexplicably or slowly with the healing of cuts and scratches, broken bones, and broken spirits. One thing I promise you will never hear me say, I will never tell you it is God's will when bad things happen to good people. When a child dies before his or her time, when disease ravages a healthy and loving spouse, when a stray bullet finds its way into the heart of an innocent bystander, you will never hear me tell you that these things are the will of God. The freedom designed into this creation has resulted in the existence of evil. Bad things happen, but it is never God's will to see evil triumph. And you and I will seek God together. It's been said none may look upon the face of God, and most believe this is because of the incredible power, might, and glory of God, but I suggest it is also because of the incredible sorrow. And I believe we will find God together. We will find God in the joy of fellowship. We will find God in the beauty of love. And sometimes, through our tears, we will find God waiting for us there in our deepest sorrows. Amen.